Blog Talk Radio. They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Your malfunction. Hello, viewers, listeners, whatever's out there listening to us. This is your host, Gore Girl. And sitting next to me is my co-host with the most, Tekayed.
Hello, Gore Girl.
We're sounding very rich tonight. I'm hearing very rich punctuation. This is awesome. I'm like, wow, I sound so good. I actually feel like the count or something. One, two, What's up, guys? Welcome to the D-Day tribute show. Woo! We played our little bugle call there. Bugle call for two reasons. One, because yesterday was the 65th anniversary of the Battle of Normandy. 65 years ago yesterday, our boys beached and were shot and just all sorts of havoc and broke through Fortress Sherup to create what we have today, which is fast food restaurants. Anyway, so moving on. But we also played the bugle call for reason number two, guys, because I don't know if you guys have heard this or have not heard this, but David Carradine, guys, was found dead. I'm pausing for it to sink in, the shock. Okay, he was supposedly shooting a movie in Bangkok, guys, and apparently they found him hanging in his hotel room. He was missing. He went to the first cast dinner. Everybody had seen him. He was at the cast crew dinner. Everything was cool. Then all of a sudden, he was missing for like, I don't know what they said, 14, 16 hours. So they went to his room and found him hanging completely. That was it. Over. The end of a legend. For those of you who are like, who the hell is she talking about? You might remember David from stuff like, his most famous role was he did the series Kung Fu. He did it for three seasons. That like his most famous character that he's ever done was Kane. Let's see what else he did. Newer fans might know him from the Kill Bill series. He played Bill. So, I mean, just huge. All the martial arts movies he's done, just all the random bit parts that he's done over the years. And he's dead, guys. He died this past. God, I can't remember what day it was I found out now. I don't know. Everybody that's on Facebook knows because I sent the Facebook out like the next morning after it happened. But yeah, he was found dead, guys. And everybody cannot believe this because this guy is so zen. This is as zen as you come, guys. Like, seriously, I don't know anybody. You could sit there, a fly could be buzzing around his head, and he's like, I will not hurt the fly. I will make sweet love to the fly. Then I will look at the fly after the sweet love is made. And we will cohabitate, and thus the Zen will begin. This is like David. I mean, this is how he was. I cannot believe that he's dead. That's insane. So first of all, I'm posing. Probably I shot this out on Facebook. Thank you for everybody that responded. But I'm also posing this because I don't believe he hung himself. I refuse to believe that. I cannot believe that guy hung himself. There, you know, then again, I'm going to put it aside. Stuff happens. You don't know people's lives. People look peachy keen on the outside, and they're tormented by demons on the inside. You never know. But I don't know. I find it really hard to believe that he hung himself. I can't fathom that. Like, he was the Zen master. Like, literally, he was one of the last guys on this planet that you would ever look at and think anything like that would ever go on. I mean, just, and what reason would he have? I mean, we don't obviously know his personal life. I don't know. But I swear to God, I think he was murdered. Perhaps it was a Vietnamese hooker. I don't know, because you know how I am about them. They stole my money, that's all I'm saying. But seriously, I don't know, boy, girl, and you can't tell half the time anyway. But seriously, it just, I don't know. I think he was murdered. I seriously think that the big sea man was murdered. I don't care. I want to hear other people. I want to hear other people's responses on it. So get on MySpace, Facebook, whatever, twit your twat or your twat, whatever, Twitter and all that crap. Twitch or twat, that's the new one.
Yeah.
Hey, I was on MySpace, was on Facebook, then I went on and like twitted my twat. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
There's like a billion of those now.
Oh my God, every social networking site under the sun. It's like people like, I just pissed. I just took the trash out. Why do we care? Why do I care what you just did like 5 seconds ago? Do you notice that? Some people that are so addicted, they're on there and that's all they talk about is they give you an update of their life. It's a play-by-play.
Yeah.
I am watching the sunrise. I'm still watching sunrise. It's like 50 updates. I'm like, shut the hell up.
I don't care, for one.
Two, you could die up in a bloody grave. I don't care.
I will eat your arm flesh and drink
God.
Cold beer with it.
Just, I can't. I crack up. Because I'm on Facebook, and I do. I like Facebook better than MySpace because it's less shit to deal with. It's, you know, I don't have to go on and be like, I get to put pictures in, and I get to, you know, MySpace page, you got to, like, you know, keep it going and stuff, keep it updated. And it's like a Facebook, it's just like a page, random. You don't have to do anything to it, random.
Yeah.
So I it's maintenance-free for me. I like it. But I don't need to know every single detail of some of these people's lives. Yeah, it's great because, you know, the number one reason I like Facebook, and I'm not lying, guys, and this sounds horrible, but I don't care because for those of you that know me, it's hysterical. But the only reason I like Facebook is because I can find out what my friends are doing and what's happening with their lives without actually ever talking to them. I never have to talk to them.
That is a plus.
I never have to talk to these people ever again. I can remain friends with them through the courtesy of a few Facebook updates. Awesome.
I like that. That is intriguing to me. I might try this.
Seriously, you should. You should link it on because you don't ever have to talk to anybody again.
And that's a plus.
You know those friends you want to keep, but you're like, oh, do I really have to call them and like keep the connection going? You don't. They're on Facebook going, oh, I just did this. And then you don't even have to reply.
You know about it.
Yes, you don't even have to reply. You just kind of look at it like, cool, they're alive.
So if you see them face-to-face in a random place, you already know what they've been doing for the past 10 years.
You're like, so how was that beer that you drank for 5 hours? It was awesome, huh? Good to see you're doing stuff. Actually, I just kind of laugh because for those I really care about, it's kind of cool to see, you know, what cool stuff people are up to, you know? But what cracks me up is the people that I really don't want to admit that, you know, that I'm trying in vain to avoid. Like, you know, those friends, I'm like, all I do is look at them like, oh, cool. They did this an hour ago. So that means they're alive. All right, that's cool. That's all I need to know. Because then, you know, you got to go through all that crap of, oh, this person's dead, I got to go to the funeral. Then you get into the whole thing. You know, what do you get? Do you get flowers? Do you get a card? You know, then you get into the whole thing. Okay, let's say you're getting flowers. What kind of flowers are you going to get? Because if you get this, this means this. And then what happens if you get this? Then you got to make sure of the arrangement. But then you don't want to get shown up by other people at the funeral with their fancy arrangements, and you come in with, like, you know, some weed you pulled out of your backyard. So now you're like, so now you feel pressured. You're like, well, I got to put some money into this now because I don't, you know, I don't want my,
yeah,
you know, puny-ass daisies to be sitting there overshadowed by some, you know, big, huge display with fireworks coming out. You're like, all right, fine. So you start dropping money into it. And then you find out you get to this flower shop, and they're like, oh, well, you should, like, put this in here too. But it's $50 more. But, yeah, you should put this in here. Are other people going to put that in there?
More.
Yeah. And then they tell you, oh, they sell you on it, and you're like, oh my God, what if other people had went to this flower shop getting flowers for this funeral, have bought that, now mine is overshadowed. Okay, yes, I'll take two of them. Okay, yeah, but then you also need this. God, well, then what happens if they came in and ordered five of those? Then you got to up, then pretty soon you're like,
order 10.
Pretty soon you're ordering like $3,000 worth of flowers. What do you do then? You know, and you're like, okay, well, just deliver them.
The only thing I care about funerals is if it's an open bar, it's a little dinner thing after. That's about it.
That is the important thing. But then what about the card? Okay, so you're not going to go with flowers. If you go with the card, then what? So then you're like, well,
you got to put money in it.
Yeah. Then you're thinking, is that tacky? Like, should I put a nice fancy, should I give them a Winnie the Pooh check to make them happy? Like, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know? So you're like, okay, I'll just stick some cash in the card. I always feel like you're like paying a bribe to somebody. Like, here, your family member died. Here's $40 to spit on their grave, you know?
Do cost a lot of money.
You figure, well, you think that's where the money's going. Chances are the money ain't going there. You know, it's going for them to go get some brown chicken afterwards or something after they eat the crappy funeral meal, you know, all that dry chicken and stuff. So, you know, you're like, okay, well, then you got to pick out the card. So then you're like, okay, well, I don't want to be upstaged by cards. I don't want to get them some, you know, cheap thing I printed off my computer. I'm going to go to Hallmark. That's right. I said Hallmark, biatches. So you go to Hallmark, right? You're thinking, yeah, this is nice. Look at these aisles, man. There's cards everywhere. I didn't even know they had cards. Cards for castrating your pets. Cards for, you know, vomiting all over your teacher. There's cards for everything. So you're like, yeah. You go into the death section, the little, you know, condolences or whatever. So you go in. Now you have to find the right card. What do you say? It's like, you don't want to be funny, but you don't want to be too serious. Then it's like, some people go a really religious bent, but then what if you don't know the religion? Like, what if you start talking about all this stuff and you find out they're Hindu or something, you know, and you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I completely offended your family, and now they're coming after me with pitchforks and fire. Well, I'm sorry, damn Hallmark, you know? Then you get to Hallmark, and what do? They're trying, you should really include a teddy bear with this card. But it's a funeral. Why would I put a, who's going to enjoy the teddy bear? Well, the family will look at the teddy bear, and for years to come, they'll remember your generosity upon so-and-so's death. But it's a teddy bear, and it's a funeral. This doesn't make sense to me. But what if other people have gone to this Hallmark and have bought said teddy bear to go with the condolence card? Now you're screwed. Now you need to buy two of these teddy bears.
Then you need to buy the box of chocolate.
Exactly. Then you're like, what else you got? Then you pop in, you know, it's Hallmark. So every movie they have is about either somebody's husband cheating on them or some kids with Down syndrome. So then you got to include a video. So you include a video with it. Well, now what are you going to, you know? It just, it goes on from there. This is never ending, this funeral thing. So this is why I am glad. Oh, and like you said, the dinner. Then what? You got to go to dinner. Now you feel, okay, do you know the family that well to go to the dinner? Are you kind of like a hanger-on, you know, like the Wedding Crashers? You're a funeral crasher. You show up, wow! Oh, wrong event. Oh, I miss you, man. I miss you.
Or you just like act like Will Ferrell and just try to pick up people at the...
You should. Well, see, it's awkward. The whole thing's awkward because everyone's crying. You're like, well, you know, that chick's kind of hot. You know, like the whole Will Ferrell thing. You know, oh, that chick's hot. I'll bang her. Well, you know, she's like blubbering all over the place. Her snot hanging off her face. Ah, that's why they make paper bags. I mean, you know, it's never ending, this funeral thing. I don't understand. So you go on and on and on with this, and it's I don't know. I don't even get it. So this is why I like Facebook, because I can tell that my friends are not deceased, which saves me. I mean, I don't really care if they're dead or not, but it has nothing to do with them. It has to do with me. But, I mean, then I know I do not have to worry about, you know, getting cards, getting flowers. I don't have to go into this whole thing. I don't have to get into this whole thing. This is weeks. This is weeks of torment. There needs to be training for funeral going. There needs to be training. I think, you know, I'm hearing, like, get a little sweatband, you know, oh my God, there'd be a lot of WWDD. What would death do? You know, something like that. A little headband, like, you know, and you're in there and you're going, lift the coffin, pull the coffin down, lift the coffin, put the. I mean, you know, there should be training. I would seriously go to training for this. I don't know. That's all I'm saying. I mean, it's just, this is weeks of torment. So you know what, you son of. I can't even say it on air. I'm going to get another fine.
Beaches.
Yeah, Sons of Beaches, like the beaches of Normandy.
Exactly.
Which is why we're in a D-Day tribute. That's the show, folks. Goodbye.
Talking about Facebook.
That's the show, folks. No, so you sons of beaches out there who have the audacity to get hurt, to get sick, or to die, look what you're doing to us. Look at what we have to go through and the money we got to spend. Money that could be spent on, what, a new Xbox video game, a new DVD, a new 3D horror movie. This is money that could be spent for this. And you guys are making us get flowers and cards. This is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
That's why I propose that we need to limit it. Limit funeral buying gifts to like $10.
Yeah, it's like once you hit the $10 mark, oh, cool. Cool. You're good. You're set. You are so set. There's no upstaging. There's no shadowing, whatever. Oh, my God. Are you serious? God, this is why I'm glad we got off Blog Talk. My God, Blog Talk, Facebook, they're all the damn same. You know what? This is, I think you could just probably log right back in.
I don't think it kicked us. I think just the switchboard would have
kicked. It's hysterical. You get, this is what I love. I love. So let me finish the Facebook thing. So anyway, thank you to Facebook for alerting me my friends are not dead. That's all I care about. That is all I care about. But also, I'm so glad that we're on other stations so our archives don't get dropped because Blog Talk just crashed again. And I like their little page that pops up. Oops! We completely ruined your show! I'm sorry! You're just like, what? Excuse me?
They put such a face on it.
Oh, my God. It's like the Tony Moran show. Oh, my God.
I don't even want to go.
My arms are getting hot.
I don't even want
to. My arms are getting hot just thinking about it. The freaking Tony Moran show. That is the lost episode, guys. Oh, we did the Tony Moran show. The original Michael Myers did this awesome interview, right? This is before we switched over and started doing other stations. We were just on Blog Talk. I don't know what the hell happened. Everything looked like it was good. There was a glitch halfway through the show. We're like, we didn't see anything change. We're like, okay, we'll just keep doing it, you know? We keep going. We come to find out that Blog Talk completely shut down. Like,
for like 10 minutes.
Internationally, completely shut down everybody's show that did it that night. We lost the entire interview with Tony Moran. I was so pissed because, actually, I think I was in shock. I don't even think I had a reaction because I was like, wow. Wow, we lost an entire show. Like, no, we had like the first 10 minutes of us bantering, and then you hear us say, woohoo, when we come back, we got Tony Moran! And then dead.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And so the next interview, or the next show that we did, I had to literally go back and forth and do like the whole interview over, like by myself, pretending I was Tony, pretending I was me, Tony, me. Just back and forth with the whole thing, trying to recap that. I hate Blog Talk. I hate you so bad. I think I was in shock. I think all of us. I don't think any of us said anything. I think the realization hit that we lost that episode. And I remember your face. You just kind of looked at me and you're like, well, we have a couple of options here. And it's like, please tell me one of the options is to blow up Blog Talk Studios.
Yes.
Oh, my God. We've got Missing Tic Tac. It's yours. Take it.
I'll take it.
Oh, my God. We don't let those go to waste. So we're fighting over Tic Tacs here, guys. This is how bad it is. How bad it is over here. So anyway, I'm blabbing on, but I just thought I'd tell you. So all that good stuff. But I don't know. So I did post on Facebook that I think David was murdered. Somebody else posted a very good thing. They said they think he died of what is it? Oh God, erotic asphyxiation, which could lead to my Vietnam hooker idea.
Yeah.
Could be. So this Vietnam hooker comes in, you know, he likes it a little rough, likes to be suffocated, you suffocate them. That's still murder in my book. I'm still right. He's murdered.
But that's a good way to go, though.
Seriously. This is, I'm not trying to downplay this in any way, guys. His death is completely tragic. This is an icon. This is a cult legend. This guy was, wow, I mean, just amazing. And just talking to him, if you've ever read interviews or heard him, I mean, he was just a profound and amazing guy. He had a very, well, I guess from what we saw, a congenial outlook on life. I mean, just was very zen. And I cannot see him doing this. But like I said, we don't know. We don't know what happened, you know, behind the scenes or whatever. But he was set to shoot a movie. He was on set. So I have no idea, you know, what happened. He was in Bangkok to shoot this movie. I have no idea what happened, but yeah, suffice it to say they found him hung in his hotel room, and I don't know, the world is going to miss you, Dave. I miss you already. I was completely outraged, completely saddened when I saw it, and I can't believe it. I refuse to believe he hung himself. Absolutely refuse. He was murdered. I don't care. I don't know what happened. I think he was murdered. If it was some sort of sexual, you know, whatever, that's, I don't know, whoever did it, that's still murder in my book. So that's all I'm saying is I don't believe that he did it on purpose. I don't know. I don't know, though. But the police say they showed no signs of assault or anything on the body. So I don't know. It's all kind of a little mystery. We don't know what's happening here. But anyway, moving on. We miss you, Dave. We love you. I'm putting up a new section on the website called Freshly Interred, which not in a turd, but interred. I know some of the fans are questioning this already. But so anyway, I'm putting that section up. B. Arthur's going on there. Dave's going on there. Who else died? I say Marilyn Burns died? No. God, no. What am I saying? I don't know. Some other people died. So we're putting all the people who died on there, and it's going to be great, and we'll do a little retrospective or whatever, have a little picture of them, and you know, good times like that. So we'll miss you, Dave. Anyway, getting back to it, yesterday was the 65th anniversary of D-Day, guys. I personally love D-Day. It's one of my most favorite. I'm doing a little rap or something. It was one of my favorites. Like, oh my God! Oh my God, the Hallmark thing. It affected Gore Girl. I spoke of something good and innocent.
I see bright pink and teddy bears.
No!
Flowers and balloons.
I'm drooling. Nickelodeon. Anyways, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Their little raps they had to go with it. So anyway, moving on.
I feel old now for knowing that.
Oh, no. Do you remember? Well, like, this was good programming, 90s programming.
Yes.
90s Nickelodeon programming. Yes. That was good. That shows how old we are.
Yeah.
Because they don't have crap. Like, they got all this stupid crap on Nickelodeon now. Man, we had, like, they were copying off of that TGIF, you know, with Family Matters and Full House and all that. We had Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
Salute Your Shorts. Hey, Dude. Oh, my God. The list was endless. We had all these awesome things on. Oh. And I don't care what you say. Are You Afraid of the Dark? Was the scariest goddamn thing that was ever out. Ever.
Yeah.
Ever. You watch all these horror movies, you're like, that's not scary. You watch, like, one episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark, you, like, piss yourself. I literally, like, I hear that music and, like, a chill runs up my back. I'm like,
well,
I
mean, just think of the setting around the campfire, you know?
Oh, my God. Some of their episodes were insane. Like, it's like, it was Nickelodeon, so they can't have blood, guts, and gore. So they utilized camera angles. They utilized creepy music, characters. They utilized all these other things, kind of like 1930s, you know. They didn't have the technology, so they utilized what they had, you know, tricking the eye kind of thing. They did the same thing on Nick. It was scarier than anything I've ever seen. The one episode, I cannot remember what it's called. The guy had, like, a little hand or something, and it was, like, some crazy charm or something like that. And you say things out loud and it comes true, but it's like bad stuff. So the kid's grandpa's been dead, and he's like, oh, I wish my grandpa was here. All of a sudden, all they show is they do cut shots from the kid going, oh, God, no. And he starts looking out the street. All of a sudden, the street's all foggy, and there's like, you see these like tires starting to pull up down the street. I'm like tearing up talking about it. This is insane. So this like black Cadillac pulls up in front of the house real slow, and you're like, oh, God, because they don't ever show the driver. You know it's the grandpa back from the dead, but you don't know if he's evil. You don't know what he looks like. You just don't know. It's the not knowing that kills you. So they drag this out, and the kid's like, no. He's trying to figure out a way to, like, reverse this and destroy this before the dead grandpa comes in the house. And, like, you see this fog coming, and the black Cadillac comes out of the fog, pulls up in front of the house real slow, and, like, sits there for a minute idling. Then, like, it shuts off. And, like, you see these, like, you know, boots get out of the car. And you're like, oh, my God, it's the dead grandpa. Then, like, he's walking up the porch. You're like, no, no. And then I don't know what happens, how they figured it out. They solved it. That's all I know. But, oh, my God. And that scares me now. That scares me now. I'm thinking, I could see it in my head. I'm like, oh, God. I remember sitting there going, oh, God. Oh, God. Like, they just drag it on. It's hysterical. So, I don't know. Good times. But, anyway, back to what we're talking about. So, D-Day was yesterday, and that is one of my most favorite battles of all time. If you have to pick a favorite wartime battle, that was my favorite. But it just, the whole commemoration of it, just the whole thing that played out, it was the biggest and most complicated wartime procedure to ever happen. And I think it still has that credit as being the most complex strategy of war to ever occur. That was every single element of D-Day had to be in place for it to work. And what was hysterical was D-Day itself was actually a complete failure, if you look at it. Nothing went as it was supposed to, but it worked well enough to make it happen. So that was just, I find that just, wow. And that's some good old-fashioned ingenuity on the part of our troops, because if, you know, I'm going to start going through D-Day here, but if you look at certain situations that happen, if our troops didn't just take it by the balls and do it, we would have lost, seriously. So look at it like this. All right, D-Day, let's say, we're just going to jump into this because I know we're like running short on time because we ran way over in the Facebook thing, but whatever, it's all good. So, and after we come back from the break, we're going to have Janet Harper talking about past lives, which fits into our D-Day thing. So you're going to want to stick around for this if you just kind of like are like, woo, D-Day, I don't know what's happening. So you're going to want to stick around for that. But, so here you got D-Day, or nicknamed Operation Overlord. It was headed by, and I'm going to skip a lot of, you know, details about the beginning, but there was so much that went into the planning of this. Even before Eisenhower got chosen as the supreme commander for the expeditionary force on this, way before this happened. I mean, this was being plotted out. Eisenhower actually had this all planned out years before they actually even said that he could do it or they were even going to try. The only reason that they didn't do it sooner, like years and years before, was because Britain was not on board. And in order for this to work, they needed the U.S. and the British troops to be on the same page and to work together, because one without the other would not have worked. It would have failed. So Britain wasn't on board until much later. But anyway, they finally get Eisenhower on. And they had he was the supreme commander with the stipulation that his three co-generals or whatever, but they were kind of like referred to him. Those three had to be British. So it was Mallory, Ramsey, and Montgomery. Those were the three Brits that were kind of in charge under him. So, I mean, just absolutely amazing. They conflicted on everything. But you get up to D-Day. This has been built. I mean, okay, when they decided to go through this, this is the plan, we're going to do this, let's make this happen. Just the planning that went into this, they could, first of all, I mean, just all the stuff that they thought of as far as where to attack. Hitler knew that they were going to try to attack the coastline. He knew this months before the attack happened. However, as based on, it was almost like a football game, because Hitler almost kind of like sat there with the rewind button. He looked at all the battles that they had fought previously, even in World War I, and he had noticed a pattern amongst the Allied troops. The pattern was that they would never attack. Obviously, I mean, it was common sense at the time. You don't attack anywhere that you can't bring more troops or equipment in. So if you're attacking over water, you want to attack somewhere that has a port. Common sense. You got to get your troops. You got to get all your equipment there. So obviously, Hitler at the time was like, yeah, they're going to attack the coastline. Let's go in it, send Rommel in it, and let's go just, you know, fortify everything that we can along like a 3,000-mile stretch along the French beach. Let's do this. Let's go. Let's get this coastline, you know, barricaded. So they did everything. Anti-tank, you know, ditches, and, you know, they took old railroad ties and molded them together, you know, to create juts in the road in case, you know, to fight off troops and tanks and, you know, any sort of transportation they were trying to get in. They just went and barricaded everything. But they fortified the port cities the most, because obviously they thought, port cities, got to fortify these. They need to get ships, troops, all this stuff in. So anyway, at this time, you know, Operation Overlord, they were running dry drills. Dry drills? Yeah, dry drills. I'm like, dry drills? Yeah, whatever. You know what I mean. So they were running these just sort of, I guess I'm just going to say it, dry drills. They were running these dry drills all over the coast, all over England. And they were just running this. They had troops coming in by the, you know, boatload, plane load, whatever. They had troops just flooding into England for about a two-month period of time before Operation Overlord actually happened. England was flooded with Canadian, American, British troops everywhere. And the British hated the American troops because obviously this is their home. So, you know, all the girls are there, all this is there, whatever. These are their pubs. These are their streets. These are their houses. And, you know, it was just troops flooded on all the streets, just troops everywhere, you know, in trucks waiting for the go. You know, the week before was chaotic. There was just troops lined up and down these streets and, you know, transportation trucks and, in, you know, jeeps and all sorts of stuff. And just sitting in the street, you know, there's pictures of them playing with kids. There's pictures of them, you know, one of them's turning a jump rope for some little girl. They're just waiting for the word to board the ships to cross the channel. So the British disliked the Americans being there most of all because they said they were oversexed. And what did they say? Oversexed braggarts who were paid too much. So that's what they said, because they went in there and they were schmoozing with all the girls, you know, trying to make it happen before they left and all this good stuff. And then, of course, there was a lot of racial tension before they got on the boats, because at the time, obviously, still black and white soldiers were separated. Well, on England, it's kind of a small place. So they were all kind of shoved into England. And they actually had to, I guess England at the time wasn't as racially divided as America was. Unfortunately, fights started breaking out so regularly on the streets and in the pubs, they actually had to pass temporary laws that said that the blacks could go in on certain nights, like Tuesdays, Thursdays, whatever, and the whites could go in on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays. They actually segregated the pubs and the businesses in England so that to keep the white and black soldiers from racially clashing. Just insane. And England at the time, you know, this was kind of unheard of, you know. I mean, yeah, there was a little bit of tension, but not as much as in America. So, I mean, they kind of brought all this over with them. So all this is happening. You know, just imagine all this tension, because you realize you're going into one of the most sophisticated at the time, sophisticated, complicated, almost psychotic mission that you could ever think of. It's almost like somebody just dreamed it and said, let's do this. It was not even attempted before. So here you are, and all this is happening where you're at, and you are literally ready at the drop of a hat to go, boom, let's go. Let's jump on the ship. Let's go. We got to get on. We got to get on. We got to do this. Okay, I got to be here. I got to be here. I got to be at the station. I got to go over here. So all these troops are just smashed into this island. It's tense. They actually ended up boarding a week before June 6th. They ended up boarding most of the troops onto ships and stuff, and had them stationed on different points around the English Channel. But still, so the soldiers that were on the ship were even more, you know, tense and everything like that, because here they are for a week stuck on the ship, which are already overcrowded. And, I mean, basically, what are they doing? They're playing shuffleboard on a makeshift hooks on the deck, you know? I mean, they're just insane kind of stuff that they were doing. So, I mean, you can imagine the tension that's building. You can imagine what's going through these guys' minds, you know, and everybody's saying the same thing because they were told the same thing. They were told that paratroopers were going to go behind the lines before them, secure all the bridges and all the railways, and that the bombing from the air raids that were happening 5 minutes or less before they land on the beach and the Allied ships that were in the channel were going to provide cover for them. They said between the two of those, they'd have no problem. They were going to walk on those beaches, walk up those hills, and be like, boom, we got this. We're good. We're golden. This is what they were told, was that most of the German forces on the beach would be annihilated before they even stepped foot on the beaches. So all the Americans, I mean, there wasn't that panic. Because, I mean, everyone was tense. Everybody's like, oh, God, because it's still war. But it wasn't as intense because they didn't know what was waiting for them. They were told up, down, left, right, sideways, through the drills, through the practices, through everything, months and months and months of training and repeating battles and repeating landing exercises. They were told over and over, there's going to be no resistance. There's going to be no resistance because you're going to walk right on that beach. It's fine. The air raids got it. They're annihilating everything. You're good to go. All the nests will be taken out. So these guys didn't really, you know what to expect. So anyway, you get in the water. Let's speed it up a little bit. So these guys get in the ships. They're crossing the channel, right? Well, anyway, the paratroopers, a little bit after midnight, they started to land behind enemy lines. Started to land in there and started to, everybody on D-Day had missions, so they started to try to secure their objectives for that day. The ones that were really successful as far as paratroopers were the ones on Sword and Juno beaches, because they actually secured two of the most important bridges, which today are actually named after them. They're actually named after, like, Gods of Flight, sort of Words of Flight, Pegasus. I can't remember what the other one was named. But anyway, those two bridges were the most vital in us apprehending during those hours. So the paratroopers go over. They apprehend that. Most of the other paratroopers got scattered. A lot of them, their chutes didn't open. They ended up dying on impact. One cool thing about the paratroopers is they released a dummy paratrooper called Rupert. They had thousands of these Ruperts. They were just sacks of potatoes made to look like people. And they called them Rupert. And they gave them little, like, there's little drawings. Some have faces, some don't. And they dropped them behind enemy lines with them. So the Germans were completely confused. Already the Germans were confused as they were starting to get the first encounterings of these sparse groups of paratroopers, because they were like, what the hell's going on? Because, of course, as we said, you have to attack a port. Well, the U.S. would not release Operation Overlord until they could figure out a way to land on a beach and makeshift a pier, a port. So anyway, they sent some of their top engineers to figure out a way. And Churchill actually said, I don't care how. I know it's impossible. I know the odds are against you. I don't want to hear questions. Figure out a way to make this happen. We need stationary ports. We need stationary places for people to land. Make it work. They ended up figuring it out. They ended up constructing it. Most of the factories in England went towards constructing, you know, the concrete pillars and things like that for the ports. So, I mean, this was key in Operation Overlord because they couldn't get the rest of the troops. What would happen? You get everybody over on the boat and then that's it?
Yeah.
Hi! It's just us, you know? Like, you need a way to get your people over.
You need to get the tanks in, the
supplies. Yeah. It's like, what if they can just stand there and go like, hi, we're joking. Yeah, we'll just go
yeah,
back.
Yeah, what happens when the Germans finally come with their little pan, you know, with their pans?
Exactly.
You know, they're like sitting ducks.
So it was what they were trying to figure out. Like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So pretty much they go, and I know we're about 5 minutes, so all right, I'm trying to figure out the time here. So anyway, I'm going to speed this up. I know it's horrible to speed up D-Day. I'm sorry. If we run over, we run over. So anyway, you go in. Paratroopers go, they secure, blah, 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 Rupert. Okay, we started to go with the air raids. Now, the problem with the air raids was, and the air raids were successful in, I mean, it's not to say they were a complete failure. That would be horrible to say that. They did take a lot of machinery out. They did kind of take a lot of things out. They did kind of blunt some stuff. But actually what ended up happening during the raids was that they were afraid of hitting the Allies in the boats below, so they waited a few extra seconds before releasing their bombs, and they ended up hitting more cows than they did beach. So the artillery that was supposed to be down when the troops landed was actually kind of safe and untouched and sitting there waiting for them, which is part of the problem that we ran in at Omaha. So you go into this anyway. So now that they figured out, hey, we got ports, okay, we can just attack anywhere on the beach. We don't have to attack a city. They started to attack just a similar stretch of beach. No cities. There was one city all the way in the north and one city, almost all the way to the west. And they attacked in that stretch in between. So here they go. The first beach was Utah. It was mostly American troops. Anyway, they ended up landing. What was funny about Utah was that it was, what's the name? Theodore Roosevelt's oldest son, Teddy Jr., was actually the hero that day. He ended up rallying most of the troops on Utah. So anyway, Utah came in to some resistance, not much. Bada bing, bada boom, they made it over. Then the next beach was Omaha after Utah. Omaha, they landed a little bit off of their objective. Well, anyway, they ended up landing, and Omaha was the least touched by the air raids and the least touched by any resistance of any kind. So this is why Omaha is our bloodiest beach for D-Day, because when the troops landed, they were massacred. They were absolutely massacred, and the ships in the canal were ordered not to fire until the troops took over the German bunkers. They were not allowed to provide cover fire, which was absolutely ridiculous. So here are all these ships captains on these huge battleships, and they get to fire, but all these lesser ones that could get, you know, in a little bit closer, I mean, almost close enough to, like, see the whites of their eyes, so to speak. They could get close enough to the beach to provide enough cover fire right there and get in there and have more accurate aim were not allowed to fire. It was supposed to be the big battleships that were supposed to send fire in and the air raids. And the troops were also told that the air raids would provide them with trenches. There were no trenches anywhere on the beach because the air raids. So they ended up getting on the beach going, oh, crap, we've got a lot of resistance. There's no trenches, and everyone's dead. What do we do now? So anyway, while the kids are scrambling and trying to figure out what to do, and the Higgins boats are dropping them off left, right, and sideways, and, you know, the ramps are falling down, and people are just getting slaughtered everywhere, they're trying to figure out what to do. And the hero for the day, there was two heroes, actually. Well, I mean, everybody was a hero that day, but the two people that really pulled off Omaha Beach was Norman Cota. When he walked onto the beach, he walked on with a cane, just walked. While everyone's ducking and hiding from all the fire, he walked on the beach with a cane and a cigar sticking out of his mouth, walked right through the fire, right up to the bluff, and said, what are you doing? We got to go kill these goddamn krauts, and decided to rally everybody. So he ended up rallying all the troops that were there, all these troops that were hiding and scared and just, you know, assembled everybody and said, we're storming this now. We are doing this now. And he rallied everybody together and ended up taking Omaha. They ended up securing the bunkers. They ended up climbing right up there and taking everything out and ended up clearing the roadways off the beach. Awesome. So Norman Cota. Then, so I was talking about these ships that are out there, right? I think his name's Rainey. Anyway, he's sitting there watching this going, God damn it, we can't do anything. We're not supposed to fire. Well, if all the American troops on those beaches followed their orders that day, D-Day would have failed. Almost none of the troops on any of the beaches, none of the paratroopers, none of the gliders, you know, almost nobody followed their orders for that day. And we are glad they didn't, because D-Day would not have worked. So anyway, Rainey's like, okay, what do I do? Do I disobey orders and provide them cover fire or let them get slaughtered? And he said, screw this. So he said, and drove his ship over there. Soon others followed, provided the cover fire needed that Cota needed to get the troops up the bunker, and they ended up taking Omaha. So awesome, awesome there. Then after that, you had Point the Hawk, where the actual Rangers got in and were just completely getting slaughtered. It was a crucial point for them to hit because they had six of the major German artillery sitting up on the cliff. They needed to take this. This was an absolute point that Overlord needed. They needed these gone because those six guns could take out all their aircraft, could take out all their allied ships in the canal and all the troops. They would have all been butchered. Point the Hawk was the most important thing that needed to be undertaken. Well, with some ingenuity and some disobeying orders, they ended up taking it. So good job with that. Then you go over to Sword Beach, which was the British. Awesome job that they did. They came into one of the least resistance. Ended up getting up there, ended up doing it, taking over some of their objectives. The most successful beach ended up being and it was almost as bloody as Omaha, but Juno Beach that came after that, which was mostly Canadians and some of the French resistance. Then you had Gold Beach, which was mostly British, Australian. So good times with that. But those three, Sword, Juno, Gold, ended up taking over most of their objectives that day, conquering some of the towns. So basically, here's the Germans, right? So now that's the Allied side. I give you like a quick run-through version of the Allied invasion, right? So here's the Germans now. They're completely confused because they've got paratroopers, fake paratroopers, gliders. They have no idea what's the thick French countryside, how many people are landing. They have no idea. So there's like five paratroopers sitting in a bush. They think there's a million. They have no idea. They're completely confused. Their communications were cut off early on and jumbled, so they had no idea what was going on. They were falsely reporting attacks on the other side of France while the invasion was going on. Anyway, Rommel ended up getting word. You know what's kind of funny about this? He ended up going back a few days before to give his wife a birthday present. Ended up being there, going back to Germany, gave his wife a birthday present, found out that morning as he was there, like exactly got there, found out, oh, yeah, the Allies are they're kind of invading our beaches. And he's like, ah! So he finds out where, and it's not a port city. He's like, damn! So he gets in this car because he cannot fly back there because he hears this invasion's going on, and all the airspace over Fortress Europe is closed off because they don't know where the Allied planes are. So he spent all of D-Day in his car driving back to France. So he was a little pissed. He was a little pissed, needless to say. Anyway, there's a couple things that happened. Like I said, it was all happen chance, all crazy. Half of the people didn't follow orders. There was Lovat and his Green Berets from Scotland with their bagpipers running around. I mean, they had one of the most funny stories of the whole D-Day. I mean, just crazy stuff like this was happening. But here you go. You got all this stuff going on. The Germans are confused. Anyway, Hitler was not woken up because he gave strict orders that he wanted to sleep in late that day. So they didn't wake him up till around noon, and he basically brushed it off and said, well, good. I'm glad that they're here because now they're on our land, and now we'll kill them all. That's what he said. Against all of his generals and his supervisors, everybody or his, you know, cohorts, whatever, not supervisors. But anyway, here they're all telling him, Hitler, doesn't look too good. There's some stuff happening here, and they're kind of getting pretty far into the countryside, and you want to do something? And he's like, ah, let them come. Ah. Most of their forces were on the Eastern Front fighting Russia, which was a war that everyone says Hitler should have started about 2 months sooner so he could have missed the cold, but it was that damn Yugoslavic battle that he fought that kind of threw that off. So anyway, he's delayed. All his majority of his fortress is over fighting Russia in a sort of uphill losing battle. So here he is, and he's like, okay, well, I don't know what to do. What was funny and what no one knows to this day is a few of his 21st Panzer Division was sitting right there between Sword and Juno Beaches. He did not deploy them. No one knows why to this day, because he made a lot of mistakes that day that he's never made during the war, and no one knew why he did this. Could it be stubbornness? Could it be he didn't want to admit he was wrong? We don't know. No one knows to this day why he didn't do certain things. Anyway, good point I want to bring up is the difference between American troops and German troops. Well, actually, just American and German in general. And this is kind of an interesting, if you think about it, it's an interesting paradox between democracy and dictatorship. The Americans were told and encouraged that if something went wrong, do whatever you got to do. You have enough training, enough background. We gave you enough cojones, whatever you need to do to make it happen. If it doesn't go according to our plan on paper, forget the paper. Do what you got to do. You know you're military. You know what you need to do. You don't need our permission. You have ingenuity. You get to make the decisions. On the other side, nobody was allowed to move until Hitler said. So the generals that were there could have stopped the invasion, could have secured Sword, Juno, and Gold Beaches and stopped the Allied invasion right there, but they couldn't move until Hitler woke up and told them what to do. Hitler gave specific orders. We are not. No one is allowed to think until Hitler thinks. So that's a very good difference between this and that, which could have aided in the victory on D-Day. So just awesome, awesome little facts. I mean, there's little tidbits everywhere. You know, the Higgins boat, just you know, the different kind of tanks they had there that they called funnies. I mean, just all sorts of different stuff that went on in D-Day that just made D-Day what it was. And it was the most, there was tons of crucial battles fought. I mean, look at the battles in North Africa that gave, you know, most of the generals, that gave Patton, that gave Eisenhower, that gave all these guys their, you know, sort of rank and superiority going on into the war. I mean, look at the great stuff, the strategy that happened there, you know, when they started getting into Italy. But it was, no one could break Fortress Europe until the Battle of Normandy. And this is what they needed. They needed to get inside Europe and start making some ground. So this battle was crucial. It was one of the most crucial battles for World War II. And so here you got all this happening and just insane stuff. And Hitler going on into the nighttime, Hitler is still, well, no, it's fine. We're fine. We don't need to move any troops. It's fine. Then he gave specific orders. I mean, and this stretched on. D-Day ended up stretching on. We all know this. You know, D-Day of the victory and aspects they created. They got into the French countryside. They started taking over towns. They started pushing the Germans back. There was blood battles. Montgomery was engaged in standstills with the German troops. People were dying left, right, and sideways. More generals started to get in. They, you know, the Americans had a foothold in Europe. They started bringing in all sorts of you know, troops and tanks and you know, transportation and artillery. They start bringing everything in. They start bringing in troops by the hundreds of thousands over into France. So here you got all this stuff happening. You're like, oh, my God, You know, they're getting a huge foothold. They're getting reinforcements. They're getting everything. And the Germans are literally cut off, which kind of aided in them getting caught up in the flea's pocket when you had Patton coming up from sort of the what is this direction? Southwest. What is over here? He's not coming from over here, if you could see me. Anyway, Patton started coming up under. Montgomery started coming up from above, and they smashed all the Germans in this little pocket, which they only had I can't remember, it was a 25, 50-mile separation in the east for them to escape through, like a little funnel that they could get through, and they slaughtered all the Germans inside of that pocket. Just absolute insanity. Well, obviously, a few weeks later, they ended up marching on, ended up taking over Paris, ended up, you know, conquering all the lands back, and obviously, bada-bing, bada-boom, we realized what happened. Hitler killed himself. We had VE Day, you know, victory in Europe, and, I mean, you know the rest of it. You know the rest of it. So, I mean, just absolute insanity, but it all kicked off with D-Day. And up until this point, people were getting pissed at the Allies because they were going, what the hell? You guys have been sitting around for a couple of years. You did a couple battles here. You did a couple battles here. Where's this huge battle that you're promising up us? Where's this big battle that's going to bring everybody home and, you know, conquer Hitler and, you know, free the peoples and all sorts of good stuff? And Normandy was that battle. So, guys, that I mean, just tons more little information I can give you, but that is what happened on D-Day. That is the reason that we ended up breaking Fortress Europe. We ended up getting inside, starting to pierce, you know, the German army's heart and getting in there and conquering and swarming from all over. So just awesome, awesome information. But, man, just all the little stuff. I mean, the people I could rattle off that did things. You know, the paratrooper that ended up finding the cemetery that they were going to use during the war. I mean, just all these little things about that day that I absolutely love. But that is a rough and tumble, trying to get you through it as quick as possible, which is hard because it's a huge, complex thing, but who cares? So anyway, but it doesn't matter because we conquer our time here, so it's all good. Anyway, we're going to go to break. When we come back from break, I'm going to bring Janet Harper on, who's going to talk to us about past lives. You don't want to miss it because we're going to reveal some sadistically huggy wedding stuff about ourselves. So stick around, guys.
And now a word from our sponsors. It was the biggest overseas military operation in the biggest war in world history, and its best-kept secret as well. D-Day, a military term for the first day of a military operation, was a fitting description for the event, which turned the tide of battle in World War II.
Hello?
The United States and Britain, to invade German-occupied Northern Europe, had been in the works for nearly 2 years before the summer of 1944, when the supreme commander of those Allied forces, General Dwight Eisenhower, gave his assent to begin a massive land at the French coastal town of Normandy. Those still awake in America and listening to their of June 6, 1944, were most likely listening to the harmonic band of Leo Diamond and his harmoniers. Suddenly, at 12:41 a.m., Eastern Time, the broadcast was interrupted with the first news of the invasion.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency, Transocean, said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency, Transocean, said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
Within hours, official confirmation of the invasion came in a broadcast transmitted from the supreme headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force in London.
I hear it on the phone and in the headphones.
...of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
When the news broke, the NBC radio network sounded their four-chime alert. It was an emergency signal. Sounded on the air to effect the immediate gathering of key NBC operating personnel responsible for broadcasting news.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the NBC newsroom for New York, where we are standing by to bring you the news of the reported operations against the continent by the Allies, which only the German radio has so far announced. The National Broadcasting Company intends to continue with its network service coast to coast throughout the rest of this night. This is our official notification to stations affiliated with NBC that we will continue broadcasting throughout the remainder of these nighttime hours. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Oh, my God. Good times. It's actual radio broadcasts from D-Day, guys. Yes, I know. It's amazing. Anyway, let's get right on to it. Time is our bitch tonight. So, you know what? We're going to get right into this since we're talking about D-Day, since we're in this most important battle, since we're celebrating 65 years ago that this happened, this most historic, important event in our lives that we would not be here without. We wanted to bring on and start dabbling into past life regression. So I have with me on the phone Janet Harper of Sanctuary Crystals. She's going to be here to talk a little bit about past life regression. Hey, Janet, how's it going?
Oh, wonderful. How are you?
I am excellent, excellent, excellent. So what's up with the past life regression? Give us a quick background. Like, give us what it is. What's going on with it?
Okay, well, a lot of groups believe in past lives, and then a lot don't. Religious and spiritual movements such as Hindu, Buddhism, African beliefs, Native Americans, paganism, and New Age movements do believe. And also the early Christians believed in it, but the presents do not. Islam doesn't believe in it either. But in circa 800 BCE, in Tibet, the Buddha, the soul of an important lama, reincarnates right 9 months after the passing of the lama. So it's right away it happens. Oh. And, I mean, it's very interesting because you have the knowledge of some of your past lives.
Now, how exactly do you have the knowledge of your past lives? Like, what can somebody look for to you know, to give them a clue as to what they might have been in a past life?
When you're familiar with a country and you've never been there, when you've picked up a tool and you know how to use it and you've never had it in your hand before, different foods and smells, and even people who are incredibly familiar, you're so comfortable with them, you know you've been with them before. And then sometimes images in your head come the way you were dressed, or if you're passing a field, you'll see images of a battle, and you were in it. You see yourself there, but it's not really there. Being familiar with something, I would start writing a journal down on things that just you feel like you've been there before. Like you step into a castle, and it's like you're at home. Or a dream that reoccurs over and over is a great thing. It's a clue to your past life most of the time.
You know, it's funny because, and everyone's going to be like, now, why did they bring on a past life person about D-Day? Well, it actually is a personal thing with me because one of my past lives was that I was fighting in D-Day. That is why, I mean, and I totally agree with you, Janet, because, I mean, I was a kid, and stuff, I have images coming into my head, things that I would never possibly have known. I was far too young to comprehend images and words and things that were coming into my head about it. And I was obsessed with World War II, but I was obsessed with D-Day. I wanted to know. There was just something, this pull in my stomach. I had to get my hands on everything to do with it. And when I was like, I think I was 7 or 8 years old, I went to the Cantini War Museum. And have you ever been there? I don't know.
Oh, it's wonderful. I love it.
Yeah, and you know they have these big dioramas. They build sets from World War II. You can actually walk into like a ship, and it's fully recreated like a ship, and there's actual everything. You feel like you're in there. And, you know, the trenches and stuff. Well, we go on a class trip, and everyone's like, okay, they're learning, yeah, whatever. I actually had to get pulled off of every diorama because – when I walked into the trench, I don't know what happened. I don't remember. They said that I kind of went all woozy, but I started going around and touching things and saying people's names, and I started to kind of shake a little bit, and I was completely obsessed with being there, and I didn't want to leave. it felt like home to me. It felt like familiarity to me. And I started to say things, and my teacher actually had to physically remove me from each of the dioramas because I refused to leave, and they didn't know what was going on with me. And so all the other kids would have walked off 10, 15 minutes ago, and here I was, basically my arms clung around the ladders, not wanting to go because I knew it. And I, to this day, I had no idea, up till recently, till I started, getting into more spirituality, when I was a kid, I had no idea what it was. And then I'm like, oh, could it have been? Ah, so good times on that.
Yeah, it's an incredible feeling when it happens.
What was your past? I mean, I don't want to pry into yours, but do you want to share with the listeners one of your past lives?
Sure, I could go over a couple things. When I was 13, I was in Czechoslovakia, and touring, parts where I wasn't before. At the age of 9, I was there before. And I knew where we were going, even though I've never been there. There was a small road just going up a hill, a dirt road, with tons of pine trees reaching the sky. And I asked my aunt and uncle, are we going to the church with the birds? And they, stomped on the brakes and went, huh? Well, at the end of each pew, there's cages with pheasants in it. Now, I had no idea where we're going each day because it was a surprise. So they were like baffled, how did I know that? And I didn't even think about it then. And then there was a place in Moravia that we were in a town square and feeding the birds what we didn't eat, the bread we didn't eat for the day. And I asked my aunt and uncle for more gorumi, which are the money there, for more bread. And they're like, where are you going to get more bread? And I led them a few blocks away from the center of the square and around the corner to a bakery. Now, I had no idea it was there, but I did. But when I was 13, I didn't even think about it then.
Right, right. That's this same things. You don't think about it. And I mean, so like anybody out there, pretty much like you're saying, if you have similar occurrences or you're somewhere, the familiarity, that tends to show you that you've had a past life there. How can, now I heard about this past life regression. What's the best way to find out what past lives, or if you were Cleopatra, or all these people saying they're Joan of Arc, what's the best way to figure out what you were?
Psychics can tap into past lives. And then yourself can also, with the memories of different sensations that you have towards things you're not familiar with this lifetime, will help you. And when you're ready, it might just start flowing. A song triggered it for me, and I remembered a year and a half of a past lifetime, my 12 children, my spouse, the grandparents. And what's funny is most of the people are actually here this lifetime with me.
Wow.
And it's weird when you start remembering that, and the familiarities, when you look in their eyes, it's like, oh my gosh, that personality usually, it doesn't change.
So what?
And
you were saying psychics. What about those people that supposedly they regress you? They do a past life regression. They bring
a hypnosis.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not that familiar with it, but for me personally, because I remember that a lot of things. I would be afraid to if I didn't know what was going on. I would need to find out if it's a reputable person that will do the regression, because you could get to a horrific part of your life and they might not know how to get you out of that. Like you might have been killed and they're trying to talk you through that, but they're not knowledgeable enough to get you through it properly. So be careful and look, do your research. But I'm not that, I don't know that much about it, but I know that.
Yeah, what would you say to them? What would you suggest to the audience out there, to people that want to know how they can find out? So are you saying keep a journal and maybe what about meditation?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Meditation is a wonderful way because before your meditation, you can ask your God, angels, guide to help you remember. Also using crystals. There are several different crystals that you can use during meditation that will help you. And there's opal, moldavite, merlinite, diaptite, Herkimer diamonds, charolite, emerald. There's a lot of them that whether you just hold them during meditation or you can actually tape them to your third eye or different parts of your, you know, body if you'd like to help you remember. And then right away when you're out of that meditation, write down what you have learned. Also, before you go to sleep, you could do the same thing. And it'll come to you as a dream, so you can get up, you know, and then write that down also. And there'll be, you know, different things that'll always show up in a dream to give you that clue. And once you get that clue, then there'll be another clue.
So it,
or some,
I mean, it's just, it's astounding. So you were kind of saying all these, you know, religions that believe in it. And, I mean, it's awesome because, you know, it seems like reincarnation nowadays is the more accepted thing. I mean, you see it in movies, you see it in books and songs, you know, it seems to be a more accepted, I don't know, I guess background or whatever, or belief, I should say belief. But
also the people don't have the fear as, you know, like
superstitious, right?
Right. The superstition that you were not allowed to believe in that, that it was taboo. Because they wanted control over you. That's all it was, is the control over man.
So now,
and their beliefs.
I know there's especially one fan out there that I'm thinking of right now that's sitting there going, okay, so how do I find my past life? What do I got to do to meditate? So do you know, like, as they're sitting there meditating, can you, like, set up a scenario for them to try to, in meditation, find their past life?
What I do is get into a relaxed state, a comfortable position, and before I start, I'll ask, you know, my angels, my guides, please help me with this past life. I remember being in Germany in, you know, a certain era. Please remember, you know, remind, you know, let me remember a little bit more. Or people who have never done this before, just please give me some insight into a past life.
Oh my gosh.
And let me remember it. I always say, let me remember it, because a lot of times when you, as soon as you come out of meditation or you wake up, you might not remember.
Right. Hence, and that would be helpful in having the journal, too, because then you can have it right there and, hey, psh,
right.
Bada boom, you know?
And I found it actually her same meditation. You know, I'll use my deity to help me remember some of my past lives also.
Awesome. Good times. I like it. It's amazing. I mean, the stuff that you can come up with, or like, you know, touching things. How do you feel? I mean, just, you know, how you feel when you touch things. Like when I went to Gettysburg and, you know, I lapsed into the battle of Little Round Top. I mean, just stuff like that. It's amazing, but I don't know. What's your most, do you have a horrific past life memory?
Little bits and pieces. Like I was killed by my husband, my second husband in one lifetime. I remember being a mother of 12 children and my husband going to battle and him not returning, and I was pregnant. And the day we buried him, I lost my child, I lost him, and I totally went nuts, and my children had to take care of me because
Sounds
totally lost it.
Awfully familiar.
Yeah.
Sounds crazily familiar. It's wild because, yeah, you can have all these horrific things, and if you're not a strong enough person, I kind of agree with you on the past life regression. Like, if I don't know, if you think you can handle it and you think you can know even the bad stuff, like if you were beheaded and all this crazy stuff that happened to you, if you were abused, I don't know. If you think you can handle it, I say go ahead and go to a hypnosis, you know, go to a hypnotist and get put under and put in a trance and, you know, try to figure it out. But like you said, what if all this negative stuff comes up? Are you strong enough? Are you capable enough on your own to be okay when you come out of it? Or are you going to be stuck in this, you know?
It's the difference between knowing that it's not happening now.
Right.
It's happened in the past. And but the fears and phobias we have now has happened in the past, like drowning. People who are afraid of water have drowned before. Or people who are afraid of heights probably either, you know, fell off a cliff or out of a plane. Or I mean, things like that have happened, and it affects us
birds,
this lifetime.
If you're afraid of birds, I don't know, or strange women that had their husbands cheat on them or Down syndrome children, you probably are afraid of Hallmark. You probably get killed by a Hallmark in half life.
Or in my case, you just don't trust women for the longest time.
Yeah, the past life thing or not. Just kidding. I think it's amazing. And like you were saying, with the whole Dalai Lama and just all the religious beliefs, and I mean, this goes back, you know, ages and ages ago, and just, you know, the spiritual center of it all. And you know, there's a lot of people today that they hear past lives, and I know they're thinking, oh man, that's so cool. I wonder if I was somebody famous. It's a lot deeper than that, because you'll probably tend to remember lives of, like, more so if you were in battle or something, like you were a witch, than you were if you were frickin' Marilyn Monroe, you know? So.
And then also, if you ever drew a picture over and over and over, a lot of times that's from a past life. Like, I've drawn two pictures, and somebody passing me, go, oh my gosh, that's Italy. That was a great find I grew up in. I'm like, okay. And then there was another one was I had somebody else passing behind me, go, oh my God, that was the gathering of all the Indians up in the mountains. And because all I drew was thousands and thousands of teepees just going into the distance into just disappearing with water and then mountains. And it was a gathering of all the Indians in the area for something special. I can't tell you what.
Right.
But it was confirmation of what I was drawing all these years.
And it's like, it was so weird because, you know, as a kid, like, I mean, I've had a lot of past life recollections. And thanks to Miss Janet, I've had a lot more past life recollections. But with you know, being the D-Day show, with the D-Day thing, it was funny because my grandfather was actually on the beach at D-Day, and he was actually one of the volunteers that stayed behind to clean up the bodies off the beach and to throw them in the back of the truck and to take them up into the to the cemetery up past the beachheads. And he would never talk to anybody about what happened in the war. He never talked to my grandma, my mom, you know, my mom's sisters, nobody, not any of my other cousins, nothing. He would never talk to anybody about anything during the war. He said that was, you know, that was the time it was, you know, what was in the past was in the past and it doesn't need to be revisited. And, you know, no one ever thought to question him. He was a very, you know, I mean, that was grandpa, you know, you don't question him. And I remember being like 11 years old sitting there and I was the only person he would ever tell stories to. And my mother would always say the same thing. I have no idea. She's like, I have no idea why he always told you. He would never tell anybody for 30, 40 years. He never told a soul what went on, you know, on the beaches, what went on in the bunkers, what went on anywhere that he was during World War II. She said, you know, he just wouldn't talk about it. And for some reason, I would sit there and he would just open up to me and he would tell me all sorts of stories and he would tell me what the bodies looked like on the beach and he would tell me the smells and the sights. And I mean, he would tell me all this stuff. And it was almost like at that moment, I felt less like his granddaughter. I felt more like I was his buddy on the beach. So it was stuff like that. Like, you're like, oh my God, you know, what if I fought alongside my grandfather on the beach on D-Day, you know? You know, you never know. What if I took a bullet for him, you know, on the beach? It's just, it's insane to think, wow, you know, I mean, it's wild. It's absolutely wild. And so I don't know, just stuff like that. Like you were saying, you know, with your past lives and with drawing pictures and the bakery and all this stuff. I mean, you have no idea why. I have no idea why, you know, I was a kid. I didn't, you know, it's not like I knew to say that. It just, it happened. You know, you don't know why it happened, but you just know. And, Very cool. So if people out there like that, or you said like fears, you know, especially like if you keep getting a constant pain in the back of your neck, chances are you might have been beheaded. And I'm laughing because somebody, I don't know who, was sort of a whore in a past life and ended up getting beheaded. And I don't know who that was. I don't know who that was. That's some craziness right there. Or claymores and all sorts of stuff. But I don't know, Janet.
She got cut off.
We booted her off. I was like, wow, she's awful quiet over there. I'm not hearing the static. We kicked Janet off. Screw you. We're done. Oh, my God. No, that was wild. That was absolutely crazy. Do you want to go ahead and try to hit her back in real fast? That was weird. Anyway, so, yeah, if you have, like, a fear or you have something like that, that's chances are it's your past life. And I kind of agree with Janet. You know, it depends on the person. If you think you're capable to handle a hypnotist, go to a past life regressionist. They're all over the place.
Get your message for
should we
Janet Harper.
Let's leave her a message. Oh, why'd you click off? I was like, let's leave her a message. So anyway.
I was already in the act when you said that.
Is it right? We're going to leave her a message.
Maybe your phone died.
That's what I think it was. Something happened. That or, I don't know. They got her head cut off. That something happened. So if you have a fear or you have something like that, I mean, you know, it's going to, you might want to look back at your camera safe. Oh, what the hell was that? We're getting EVP now through the phone.
I know.
Please leave your message for.
Yeah, I did.
This is
Janet Harper. Record your message after the tone.
Or something
to send a numeric page, press 5. When you are finished recording, hang up. Or for delivery options, press pound.
Crazy.
There's the beep.
Janet Harper, what did you do? You're not on the show. We are live, like, right now on the show and you're not on. This is crazy. This is absolute craziness. I hope to God that, you know, one of your past lives didn't come up and, like, take your head off, because that would be horrible. And that would get into the whole funeral thing that I was talking about at the beginning, and don't make me go there. Do not make me go there. Anyway, so I guess, should we just keep doing the show on her answering machine? Wouldn't that be hysterical? She has a 3-hour-long answering machine message.
What?
Yes! Do it! Oh, my God! So, anyway, we will. We're going to do it because we're sluts and we like it. So, anyway, it's stuff like this, guys. What is it that got you? What are you obsessed with something? Are you obsessed with spaghetti? Are you, you know, have you been a place and you don't know why? It feels like deja vu, but it feels more than that. Chances are you were there. Chances are you did stuff like this. If you want to find somebody that can help you, go to a reputable psychic, okay? Don't go to any Joe Schmo that's got a damn sign up that says they're a psychic advisor, okay? You know, yeah, whatever. Beat me, okay? Don't go to that crap. That's bull. I'm just saying right now, go to somebody reputable. Go to talk to people. Who's gotten good reviews? Who's gotten good rep? Who's got good, you know, PR on them? Go talk to that person. And don't call those damn 1-800 lines like Miss Cleo. Really? Really? Unless you need to learn how to lotion your ribs or something, or lotion your chicken, don't be calling those people, okay? It doesn't work, all right? And those people are like, hey, I'm a real psychic. Screw you and your 800 number, you bitch. You know? No, screw you. So, and if you are, I think that should be a show. I think one show we call all these 800 numbers and see if these people are right. That's what we're doing. We're going to make that a show.
And then we can write reviews.
We could.
Which are actually good.
Exactly. We'll do it live on air. It'll be great. So, no, seriously. So look it up. Talk to people. Find somebody that knows some of the psychics in your area. Go talk to somebody. They can help you look at your past lives. If you want to go to a past life regressionist, I don't know what it's like in other cities, but here in Chicago, there's a magazine called the Monthly Aspectarian. I think it's national, but I don't know where it's distributed in other cities or, you know, where it's at or what stores you got. But go to your local metaphysical shops, your shops that sell crystals, that sell herbs, besides marijuana, that sell, you know, stuff like that, sage, that sell, you know, Buddhist material, religious material, stuff like that, except Christian stores, because God knows you won't find what you're looking for. You won't be finding no sage in there. you know, go to a metaphysical store, talk to them. That, you know, they might have psychics, or they might be able to give you a monthly aspectarian. They might be able to direct you to a past life regressionist. So go and figure that out. Look in your area. But, yeah, up here in Chicago, we've got the monthly aspectarian comes out. It's all over the place. Our sanctuary crystals, witchy wearables, all these places have the monthly aspectarian sitting right by the door. You just grab one, and there are tons of reputable people in there, hypnotists, psychics, all sorts of kind of crazy people. So go on, look at it. If you feel that you're ready and you want to, go look at your past lives, because it's wild. You never know, you know. What if you were an axe murderer? What if you were Jack the Ripper, you know? Like, what if you were one of Jack the Ripper's prostitutes that got killed? I mean, just insane stuff like that. It's amazing. It is amazing. It's an amazing look. From a purely fun perspective, it's cool to see stuff like that. But seriously, it's amazing just for the fact of you get to see your own spiritual journey. You get to look a little bit deeper. You get to explain some of your fears, some of your traumas that you have nowadays. And Janet was talking about, she's so dead on about what she's talking about, guys. There's stones that you could get to help you, you know, if you're meditating, like carnelian brings you insight. Hematite, it's, you know, effective in hypnosis for your past life. You know, awakens your inner vision. I mean, there's fragrances like myrrh. It's a fragrance that's used in past life healing if you have trauma that you can't get over. So, I mean, it's nuts. It's absolutely crazy the stuff that you could do. And, I mean, if you want to know about stones or herbs, look it up online. See what it works in a past life meditation. Light some candles. Sit there. Trance out. Focus. Do what Janet said. Do what Yed was saying. You know, recollect. All that good stuff will come back to you. And don't kick yourself if it doesn't happen the first time. This isn't like it's, you know, coloring in the lines or something, you know. I mean, this is something that takes a little bit of mastering. And if you've got the daily world bogging down around you every day, it'd be hard for a first-time person. So, you know, try it out, guys. Just keep trying. Or like I said, go to a psychic or go to a past life regressionist. You've got tons of choices. And if you want to know, if you want to know what's going on, give me a call, especially if you're in the show.
Recording has reached the maximum length.
Oh.
To replay your
message, she's going to hate us, and I like it. So anyway, I mean, I'm blabbing on, but this is an important show, guys, because it's important for you to know what happened to D-Day. I'm not even going to pay attention to that. It's important for you to know what happened to D-Day. It's important for you to realize how critical this was. I mean, to me, it is obviously a little bit more emotional than the average bear. Because I have a lot more emotion with it being my family ties and being a past life tie. So it is a bit more emotional. It means a bit more to me, but screw you if you don't like it, you know, then don't listen. But yeah, you should, it's 65 years, guys, 65 years ago, this all happened, and it's wild to think about, absolutely wild. And like Janet Harper was saying, you can check her store out, sanctuarycrystals.com. Check them out. They're in the process of relocating right now, going to a bigger storefront. God knows they've got so many products that you could choose from, so be sure to check them out. Check the website to see where they're going to be relocating to next. But Janet Harper, owner of Sanctuary Crystals, she was talking to us about past life regression, and she's dead on, guys. Definitely. Everything she's saying, she is definitely a good person to talk to if you want to talk to her, consult with her, because she knows a lot about the past life stuff. She's been there, done that, all sorts of good things, even the traumatic stuff, which we didn't get into too much with her. So anyway, I'm blabbing on and on and on. I do have to say one quick thing before we go, because I thought this was wild. There's this kid who, back in 1721, this is kind of funny, Christian Frederick Heineken? Is he a bear? Anyway, he said to, this was a children past life thing. He said he started talking within a few hours of birth in 1721. At just 1 year old, he knew the main events of the first 5 books of the Old Testament. At age 2, he knew all of the Bible. At 3, he knew all of world history. He could speak German, Latin, and French. And in 1724, the King of Denmark brought him to Copenhagen. The infant actually predicted his own death within 12 months and died at age 4. Who is this kid, and why do I not have him on a T-shirt? Oh, my God. And he's a beer's named after him? seriously. No, it's not really, but it's funny. So I read that as I was going through the past life stuff that Janet sent me over to look at because she was cool enough to forward me some info on it. Wow, guys, wow. So anyway, that's the show. We talked about Facebook, we talked about D-Day, and we talked about past life progression. You got any more questions, hit us up on the website, hit the show MySpace up, leave us a message, hit us up at thatggshow.com or check us out on myspace.com/thatggshow. Leave us a message. You want us to help you with the past life stuff, leave us a message. Go talk to Janet, whatever you want to do, sanctuarycrystals.com. Anyway, I'm out of here. I'm excited because next week I'm going to be live from New Orleans.
You're live.
Coming to you live. I'm going to be live in New Orleans next week, guys, and I am going to hand the reins of the show over to two insane co-hosts. So you want to check next week's show out, guys. It's going to be insane. They're going to be tapping me in from New Orleans, but they're running the show, guys. So Techie Yan and Techie Yed are going to be live next week. Anyway, I'm out of here. I got a pack. I got ghosts and voodoo and cemetery to sniff. So I'm gone, guys. Enjoy your week. I will talk to you soon from the gravestones of New Orleans. This is the Gorgo Variety Hour. We talk about what the hell we want to talk about it. And if you don't like it, kiss our ass. All right, guys, bring us out of here.
Good morning from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.